Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Tricia Beattie. Today I'll be reading from recent issues of the Christian Science Monitor. In the limited time we have, I'll read from their section called One Week, which is a series of brief articles and commentary on the top stories of the past few days. People Making a Difference. Yos, Nigeria. Deaf Technology Foundation helps students crack the code for confidence. By Nathaniel Biven, contributor. In a one-room apartment in Yos, Nigeria, instructor Wuni Bitrus and almost a dozen students gather around a table cluttered with equipment. A toolbox, a 12-volt adapter, a coding panel, a set of jumper cables, a mix of colored wires. The student's idea? To build the prototype for a smart door that opens with the touch of a finger. The students chat back and forth in sign language, and Mr. Bitrus signs back. The group discusses using Arduino, an open-source electronics platform, and one student wonders how fingerprints can be stored. Mindful of Nigeria's electricity problems, Mr. Bitrus genially advises the group to use a battery-powered keypad lock system first and incorporate a fingerprint feature later. It works well rather than waste time reinventing the wheel, Mr. Bitrus says. After nodding in agreement, the students excitedly start working. This is just another afternoon in a club run by the Deaf Technology Foundation, a nonprofit co-founded by Mr. Bitrus in 2017 that trains Nigerian children and young adults who are deaf in computer programming and robotics. The students also work to improve their reading skills and receive career guidance and counseling to help them believe in themselves. Mr. Bitrus's driving force? Compassion, he says, because deaf people in Nigeria are limited in so many ways. His desire to change the prospects of Nigeria's deaf and hard of hearing community was sparked in 2014 by his encounter with a 13-year-old girl while he was teaching as part of the National Youth Service Corps in Zamfara State. Mr. Bitrus had noticed that the teen faced discrimination, and he became determined to learn sign language and teach her to use a computer. 3 years later, he marshaled the resources, including funding from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, to form the Deaf Technology Foundation. One of the darkest memories that Mercy Sampson Grima, a foundation student, has about growing up is looking at the faces of people around her and recognizing insults and negative energy directed at her. That hurt me so bad because I knew in my heart that I could do anything. They just see us as lesser human beings, she says. I wanted to show them that deaf people can become whatever they want to be. Mr. Bitrus interpreted the students' comments for this article. Ms. Grima says her private secondary school did not formally teach sign language to her, nor much of anything else. But there was one teacher who knew how to sign, and she taught Ms. Grima. When Mr. Bitrus visited Ms. Grima's school to promote the work of the Deaf Technology Foundation, she was happy to see that he could sign, too. She dropped out in her third year because her parents could not pay her school fees. But fortunately, she had already formed a bond with the Deaf Technology Foundation. I had never touched a laptop before in my life, she says. Now she wants to become a computer scientist and answers to the nickname Mama Robotics. 5 years ago, Ms. Grima and several other students made a road trip from Jos to Nigeria's capital, Abuja, to compete in Make X, a robotics contest. The team had practiced for about 18 hours. In the end, it built robots to perform tasks such as cleaning trash in a model city. Although Ms. Grima's team was not chosen to go on to represent Nigeria in the international competition, it emerged fourth among about 15 teams. Our team was the only one made up of the deaf, says Ms. Grima, her eyes lighting up. Her father, Grima Sampson, adds, "What they are doing changed her. The day we are not able to transport her here to the Deaf Technology Foundation for club activities, she isn't happy. We pray that God opens doors for her and the other children to make something of themselves." Mercy Sale wanted to study to become a computer scientist, but her school told her that, as a deaf student, she could not. In October 2019, Ms. Sale was part of a Deaf Technology Foundation team that flew to the Netherlands. It was among teams from 10 organizations around the world that competed for the Nothing About Us, Without Us award, which goes to nonprofits working with marginalized or disadvantaged communities. "I started seeing the reward for where technology can take me," Ms. Sale says. Now she wants to be a web developer. Joy Youssef, another Deaf Technology Foundation student, had wanted to become a doctor. But she was moved to a new school where the principal and staff said there was no way that could happen, even though the school welcomed students with disabilities. "It was a blow for me," Ms. Youssef says. "I cried. I had to call Mr. Bitrus and my father to beg them, but the principal and staff still refused. For me, deaf tech is the only way I can have anything close to studying medicine." Now she, too, wants to become a web developer. The Deaf Technology Foundation's major challenge is a lack of funding. There are only 2 paid tutors for computer programming and robotics, and the number of students keeps growing. 34 students on average attend classes 4 days a week, but that number can rise to 70 when students are on breaks from their regular studies. To loosen up, they all gather twice a week for sports and dance. In addition to the 3 clubs that the Deaf Technology Foundation has started in Jos, it has 1 each in Zamfara State and Abuja. Most of the foundation's volunteers are older students who help conduct sports activities for club members on a temporary basis, Mr. Bitrus explains. "This is what I love doing," he says, adding that he hopes in time to see his students train others. To scale up, the foundation aims to take advantage of the technology boom in Nigeria, particularly in the robotics sector. It hopes to partner with Jos-based companies on, for example, self-driving car technology and automated wheelchairs. Lengdung Tungchama, co-founder of Genta Reads, a community initiative that aims to improve reading skills in impoverished areas of Jos, has worked with the foundation for a couple of years. "The most important thing about deaf tech is the passion of its leaders and founders," he says. "Giving people with disabilities skills that they can use to earn an income and make a future for themselves is the best thing anyone can do. People need to see that disability is not a death sentence or the end of life. That's what deaf tech does. It just gives hope to people." Perspectives on the world. Americans who kindly disagree. The Monitor's view. One measure of the health of American democracy is the Lugar Center's Bipartisan Index. Each year, it counts the number of bills in Congress sponsored by lawmakers from both parties. The latest survey shows a modest gain last year. Such numerical tracking, however, does not capture something else: the tone of disagreement in dealing with big issues. Outside Washington, that tone is often less strident, even respectful. "We can disagree and stand firm for our beliefs and principles, but we should never forget the dignity of the other human being," Tennessee Governor Bill Lee, a Republican, said last year. That conviction is the basis of an initiative by the National Governors Association called Disagree Better. It seeks to restore an ideal that cordial disagreement is a source of unity and not division. "We are trying to give people permission to have strong ideological views without vilifying the other side as a threat to democracy. Utah Republican Governor Spencer Cox, current chair of the association, wrote in the Deseret News. A Pew Research Center poll in September found 61% of voters said talking about politics with people they disagree with is stressful and frustrating. The governor's campaign coincides with a raft of similar initiatives by civil society organizations and local elected officials to counter cynicism, enmity, and disengagement. Mayors, for example, have built a growing number of bipartisan coalitions to address issues such as climate change, violence, and child hunger. In Washington state, the Democratic-controlled legislature passed more than 80% of its bills this year with support from a majority of Republicans. A consistency of bipartisanship, Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig wrote, reflects a determination to disagree without being disagreeable. Citizens are central to that idea. In Tennessee, for example, a group called TN11 brings together an unlikely coalition: a firearms instructor, a pastor, a former highway patrol captain, and a family therapist, to help state lawmakers find solutions to gun violence through a balancing of gun rights and gun safety. Their work started by just listening to each other and resulted in 5 legislative proposals. People are more hostile to others in the abstract than when they meet them in person, wrote Arthur Brooks, a Harvard professor of business and government, in his book, Love Your Enemies: How Decent People Can Save America from the Culture of Contempt. Worn out by division, many Americans find the vigor and value of disagreement rest in caring for one another. A social earthquake in Eurasia. The Monitor's view. In late March, much of Eurasia, from Armenia to Mongolia, began to be transfixed by a court case of a former top official in Kazakhstan who killed his wife. On May 13th, the man was sentenced to 24 years in prison. Not only was his violent action caught on camera, but the trial was also live-streamed, a first in Kazakhstan, for millions to watch. More than 2/3 of Kazakhs followed the trial. Even a famous Russian TV news presenter was in the courtroom, writing on social media that a quiet revolution was taking place in Kazakhstan. In a region not strong on women's rights and equality before the law, the trial of Kwandyk Bishimbaev, once a member of Kazakhstan's political elite, had an impact even before the guilty verdict. The legislature passed a law, widely known as Sotanat's Law, for the first name of Mr. Bishimbaev's wife, that criminalizes domestic violence. The law takes effect June 15th. In another sign of progress in a largely patriarchal society, both the judge and the prosecutor were women. Family and domestic violence is a pressing problem, prosecutor Aizan Imaganova told Tenegra News. I hope that after this trial, women will realize that going to law enforcement is not useless. An estimated 80% of women of working age in Kazakhstan have been victims of domestic abuse. Only 2 out of 10 survivors ever file a case against their offenders. The slain wife's brother, Aytbek Amangeldi, told Nikkei Asia that the trial has changed public attitudes. That is to say, that violence is now becoming unacceptable to society. According to 2 scholars writing in Foreign Policy, the trial snapped the people of Kazakhstan out of their despair and has become a symbol of hope that the law can lead to justice, not just be used by the government to repress dissent. Just over half of countries have comprehensive laws addressing domestic violence, according to the World Bank. In Kazakhstan, the trial has not only changed the law, but also led President Kasym Jomart Tokayev to to admit the high level of violence against women and girls, and the need for further work to end it. Everyone should be equal before the law, he said last November, after the killing of Saltana Nukanova. A just Kazakhstan is a country where law and order triumph. The Home Forum. The heartache and hard lessons of my first job. In my childhood, the working-class homes on my New Jersey street were wedged pretty close together. This meant that the freestanding, flat-roofed garages behind these houses were also lined up in inviting fashion, with just enough space between them for an energetic, long-legged boy like me to bound from roof to roof. One late afternoon, when I was 12 years old, I took a great leap onto the next-door neighbor's garage. Mrs. Strenger, her hair in curlers, came out with a broom and tried to swat me as I crested the gap onto the next roof. She complained to my father, who sat me down that evening and suggested that I look for a job, in the interest of dissipating some of my misdirected energy. Truth to tell, I had long wanted to be a working adult so that I could have some disposable income of my own. And so I began the search, going from business to business along the main shopping street, offering to sweep, deliver, clean, anything to earn a few bucks. But it was a no-go. Too young was the repeated refrain. My last hope was a small pet store run by the no-nonsense Mr. Timmerman. Mustering my courage, I begged him for a job, any job. It was near Easter, and he had just obtained a large number of baby chicks, which were chirping non-stop in the background. Surely he needed help with those. Mr. Timmerman looked me over. "You're young," he said with a hint of disapproval in his voice. But my pleading expression must have won him over, because he sighed and nodded. "Come back after school tomorrow." I was ecstatic. A job. I ran home and told my father the good news. The next day after school, I hightailed it to Mr. Timmerman's. He pointed me toward a mountain of cardboard shoeboxes in the back room. Then he handed me a penknife. "Cut a slit in every box for the chicks," he said. "That should keep you busy for a while." I worked apace, nonstop, cutting slit after slit until my fingers were cramped. But with every box I cut, my mind flew like a boy leaping across garage roofs. What should I buy? Sneakers? A BB gun? A skateboard? The possibilities were endless. After 2 hours of diligent labor, I returned glowing to the front desk. "Done, Mr. Timmerman," I said as I handed over the penknife, making sure to display my sorely taxed hands. He thanked me, and I watched as he reached into his shirt pocket. Then he handed me my pay, a pen inscribed with the name of the pet store. I was shattered, but what could I do? I went home where my father was waiting. "How was work?" he asked. When I told him my tale of woe, he pulled me in close and put his arm around me. "Did you learn any lessons?" Lessons? Was that the point of work? I looked up at my dad and said, "Yeah, always agree on the pay ahead of time." He smiled. "Let me tell you how I see it. You showed up. You finished something you started. And you did a good job. You can take pride in that." The last thing he said was, "And it will get better." He was right. It did get better. Mr. Timmerman told another proprietor that I was a reliable, hardworking kid, and I picked up some after-school hours for real pay. That first job, then, had been an investment. It enabled me to create something I had never thought about, a reputation. And it kept me off Mrs. Stenger's roof. By Robert Close. Madrid and Washington. How history led three countries to recognize a Palestinian state. By Erica Page and Sophie Hills, staff writers. When three European countries formally recognized Palestinian statehood in late May, little changed on the ground in Gaza. But for the governments of Ireland, Norway, and Spain, that's not the point. Precisely at a time when peace seems furthest away, the largely symbolic announcement stands as a desperate call to revive the two-state solution seen by most of the international community as paramount to future peace between Israel and a Palestinian state. The move is considered premature by the United States and most other European countries. They maintain that lasting peace requires a negotiated agreement first. But the move by Ireland, Norway, and Spain, reflecting in part their own cultural and historic sensibilities, is part of a growing condemnation of Israel for its war conduct in Gaza, and a matter of what they consider moral urgency. It is very likely that the war in Gaza will eventually be seen as one of the darkest episodes of the 21st century, said Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez in May. When that moment comes, I want the Spanish people to be able to say with their heads held high that they were on the right side of history. Breaking from most Western countries that demand a successful peace process in order to recognize a Palestinian state, Ireland, Norway, and Spain have turned the logic around, says Jürgen Jensenhaugen, a senior researcher at the Peace Research Institute in Oslo. More European countries are expected to follow. Now, there is the recognition that there is no peace process, and hope is almost gone, he says. So we need to try something to revive hope. It's another blow to Israel, which has grown increasingly isolated on the world stage. On May 24th, the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to immediately halt its offensive in Rafah, in southern Gaza. That follows the announcement by the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor that he is applying for arrest warrants for three Hamas leaders, as well as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Israel responded to the joint announcement by Ireland, Norway, and Spain by recalling its ambassadors from the three countries. Mr. Netanyahu called the move a reward for terrorism. The three countries condemned Hamas's brutal October 7th attack on Israel that sparked the war, and they emphasized the importance of building a Palestinian state with the Palestinian Authority, not Hamas, which the U.S., the United Kingdom, and others consider a terrorist organization. Recognizing the state of Palestine sends a message that there's a viable alternative to the nihilism of Hamas. Hamas has nothing to offer but pain and suffering to Israelis and Palestinians alike, said Irish Prime Minister Simon Harris at a press conference. Ireland's position, like that of Spain and Norway, is guided by history. Ireland has long underscored its solidarity with independence based on its centuries-long experience of British occupation. That direct and sustained experience of imperialism has undoubtedly shaped how the Irish people view the Palestinian issue, says Jane Olmeyer, professor of modern history at Trinity College, Dublin. Norway has seen itself as an important player in international peace processes, and especially as a mediator of peace between Israel and Palestinians. It hosted the meetings leading up to the 1993 Oslo Accords, a framework that ultimately fell apart. Spain, too, has historically built ties with the Arab world, including the Palestinians, dating back to post-World War II. Spain was barred from joining the United Nations because of former Spanish dictator Francisco Franco's links to Nazi Germany, says Isaias Barinata Bajo, professor of international relations at Complutense University of Madrid, and instead turned to Latin America and the Arab world for diplomatic relations. Spain didn't establish diplomatic relations with Israel until 1986, after joining the European Economic Community. Over 24 countries, primarily Arab nations, have never recognized Israel as a state. Today, Spain sees itself as uniquely positioned to play a peacemaking role in the region because of its geographic proximity and ties to both sides, says Dr. Bernyada. While these three governments have been vocal in their support of Palestinian rights, they're also responding to publics who are calling for such steps, says Hugh Lovett, senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Palestinian statehood was supported by 78% of those polled in a recent Spanish survey. With the vast majority of military support for Israel coming from the U.S. and Germany, the recognition is unlikely to affect the current course of the war, however. And some worry it could undermine their government's ability to help broker a long-term peace solution. I would have liked such a sensitive decision to be taken only when there is a consensus built with precision and care among the biggest global powers most involved in the conflict, says Diego Garacho Salcido, professor of moral philosophy at the Autonomous University of Madrid. All well-intentioned people want a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, he adds. Disagreement arises in the nuances about how, when, and through which actors we can achieve that. Still, the three acted amid a growing recognition of Palestinian statehood. Earlier in May, the United Nations General Assembly overwhelmingly backed a Palestinian bid for UN membership, a status that is only open to states. Around the world, 140 countries recognize a Palestinian state already. In Europe, that includes only Sweden and a handful of Eastern European countries. The three-way announcement points to the power these countries see in numbers. It's unlike Sweden's unilateral recognition of Palestinian statehood in 2014, which had little impact. Slovenia, Belgium, and Malta have indicated they are considering similar announcements. The countries that sign up for this will carry more and more weight collectively, says Linda Robinson, senior fellow at the Council for Foreign Relations in Washington. We're at a moment of moral crisis. People feel that they have to be very clear on the morality of how this war is being conducted and what they can and can't support. That's it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading from various issues of the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Tricia Beattie. So long for now.